Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced at CILU on Fort William First Nations territory in Thunder Bay. I'm your host, Groundwire National Coordinator Carly Forbes. In this edition, we'll hear an in-depth discussion about the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez in CBSA custody, a roundtable discussing the closing of the Mondragon in Winnipeg, as well as an update on what's happening with the laws around sex work following the Supreme Court's Bedford ruling. And finally, a community radio report about the upcoming National Homelessness Marathon. But first, here's the headlines. After having been off the air since late September 2013, Free Speech Radio News just announced that they are restarting their broadcast as of February 11th. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff has the story.
Free Speech Radio News, or FSRN, was a daily syndicated news program that was carried on over 100 community radio stations across North America until they were forced to suspend their operations last September due to a major funding shortfall. However, in a statement from FSRN board president Sanghae Akil, it was announced that the program would be returning to the air on February 11th with a new website, but a slightly different format. The program was able to restructure itself after a major funder came through with a donation at the end of last year. Since FSRN went down, airwaves across the continent have felt the lack of grassroots global voices that were provided on a daily basis by the program. Here is FSRN contributor Ghassan Banoura from Beit Sahour, Palestine, reporting on what happened in FSRN's downtime.
During the months since FSRN went offline, Israeli settlers have escalated their campaign against Palestinian farmers. During the October-November olive season, settlers uprooted nearly 500 olive trees. The olive harvest make up 30% of farmers' income in the Palestinian areas. Army attacks have also escalated, with 3 children among those gunned down by Israeli army fire. In December, many Palestinians mark Christmas. This year, as in years before, Israeli walls and policies that block tourists from visiting Bethlehem continue to lower incomes for local businesses who would otherwise welcome holiday tourists, resulting in another sluggish season. Ghassan Banoura, Bethlehem, Palestine.
Listeners and fans of FSRN will be able to find new reports, photo essays, and print articles up on their website at fsrn.org as of February 11th. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Through a Freedom of Information request, it was found that the CBSA, the Canada Border Services Agency, has a quota to deport 875 refugees this year. Red Eye Co-op Radio's Jane William has this story.
The Canadian Border Services Agency has a quota for the number of refugees they hope to strip of their status. A CBSA operational bulletin obtained through a Freedom of Information request says the agency hopes to send 875 refugees back to their country of origin this year. Border Services says that a greater focus on these cases will enable the government to improve the integrity of the refugee system. Zul Suleiman is a lawyer who specializes in immigration law.
What it seems to be suggesting is negative decisions need to be made. And so if you're a decision maker looking at these for the Canada Border Services Agency on whether to prosecute them and take them to the end, and your quota is 32 for the month, and you've only done 28, it doesn't mean you could do 4 decisions where you say, you know, these 4 families or individuals, they don't need a prosecution. It's okay. Let them stay as they are. In fact, the pressure would be to find 4 more negative cases. And that's where the fairness issue becomes a big problem. Because is the pressure to make just negative decisions, or is the pressure to make fair decisions?
Do you know what kind of people what kind of situations they're going to be going after primarily?
So these are individuals and families who came in as refugees who are accepted. And then once you're accepted, you can become a permanent resident of Canada. Between the time you become a permanent resident of Canada and a citizen, several years can go by. Those individuals who go back to their home country, say to visit an ill mother or an emergency or do something, or for other reasons, those individuals are now going to be under scrutiny for what are called cessation applications. A cessation application is basically an application where the government says, you used to be a refugee, You're now going back to the country you came from, so we don't believe you're a refugee anymore. And so what's happening is in that gap between the time you're a permanent resident and a citizen, you're very vulnerable. And there can be a myriad of reasons why you go back. So that's one type of means by which to take away your status. And the other ones are, of course, vacation applications. And those are refugees who the government believes have misrepresented or lied when they got their refugee status. If you are targeted for one of these cases, you get a notice. The hearing can be within weeks or months. So within 8, 12, 16 weeks, you could have a hearing. If you lose, your appeal rights are very limited. Your humanitarian rights are limited. Your pre-removal risk assessment rights are limited. And then it just comes down to, can they get a travel document? How much are you cooperating? It's entirely conceivable that many of these cases could be sent away within a year. In fact, the latest changes to the Immigration Act envisions a scenario where you're essentially devoid of many remedies for a 12-month period. So basically, we're going to take away your status, we're going to limit your remedies for 12 months, and that gives us that 12-month window to remove you. And that's actually the scheme of the latest amendments that have been passed into law.
That's it for the headlines. And now for our feature stories. Fatima Herrera and Maria Dolores Mora of CJSF's Latin Salad invited Shireen Sophie from No One Is Illegal and Mexican journalist and refugee Carla Latini to reflect on the recent suicide of Lucia Vega Jimenez.
Lucia Vega Jimenez, not a status immigrant, a woman who preferred commit suicide before being deported to her country. And for that, we have today a very, very interesting guest today. And?
Yes, they are Shireen Sophie and Carla Latini. Shireen is very knowledgeable about this case because she represents this organization, No One Is Illegal.
So Lucia was first in Canada and claimed refugee status in 2010. And she was then denied refugee status in 2010 and returned back to Mexico and at some point came back to Canada. And in 2013, she was arrested by transit police because she had an she didn't pay the proper transit fee, and the transit police cooperated with the CBSA, and she was put into she was incarcerated in a prison, and then afterwards she was transferred to the YVR detention center, where she committed suicide and hung herself, and then was transferred to a hospital where she later died on December 28th.
Lucia's mother is sick, and she was providing money. She wasn't criminal.
Lucia was providing money for her mother.
For the mother, yes. Yeah. So
one of the things that struck me the most is that when I think about Lucia, she trying to make her case as asking for refugee and probably not being able to provide the right documentation or the proof, as she was really facing this danger in Mexico. And I think at the end of her life, that was her biggest piece of evidence, her own death.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so. Rather preferring just attempting to your own life than seeing any other option. And before the show started with the ladies, we were commenting that in this show, we try to talk about personal development and sometimes what means depression and sad things that happens to everyone, right? We are humans and we face those up and downs. And when I think about her and with no support or no emotional help and just having this tunnel vision as it's just the end of everything because it doesn't matter if I go back or not go back, my life is over. And not having that friendly hand, right, to listen to her and just give her one little piece of hope. You know what? Tomorrow might be different. Yeah. Just hold on. And that concerns me. And I don't know who was in charge of her. Who was her custodian? Do you know, Shireen?
Well, there is a lot of focus right now on the security that was in the detention and the fact that maybe there was negligence there, and there's also a system in place. But I think there needs to be more focus on the fact that CBSA itself is constructed so that they create that isolation and they create that sense of hopelessness, and they construct that around them. There's been between 8,000 to 14,000 migrants every year in Canada who have been detained, and over one-third of all migrant detainees are held in provincial prisons. So, and many of them are held in provincial prisons in mixed with those who are facing criminal charges. So we're seeing that Canada literally is understanding migration to be a crime. So one of the demands that we have is that the coroner have an investigation into the death of Lucia, because actually there's a policy that if anyone is to die under the custody of police or an authority, then they have to have an inquest. The coroner has to have an inquest to find the facts into that. And so we're putting pressure on the BC Coroner's services to look into those facts and to have that inquest, because so far there's only been an investigation by the Richmond RCMP, which is extremely inappropriate and unjust, because you cannot have a police on police investigation, and they have already finished their investigation, and so we don't even have all the information and all the facts. So there needs to be more investigation, and there needs to be a coroner's inquest.
Not only a tragedy, I think this is injustice. And I think this is injustice no matter if you came from Mexico or, I mean, no matter the country. This is an immigrant's country. And that's why we are very concerned, because we don't want anyone more died.
And now Daniel from CKUW Winnipeg's The Black Mask brings us an excerpt from a roundtable of the closing of the Mondragon, an activist organizing space that recently closed after 18 years of being in the community.
We have a panel discussion with three members three former members now, of the Mondragon Collective.
I worked at Mondragon from 2002 to about 2005. My name is Jacob.
My name is Sandra, and I've been at Mondragon since the beginning, so from 96 until now.
I'm Cora. I started working at Mondragon in February of 2012.
So we had purchased the building, and the idea was that we would have a place where the activist community could gather and have community space and have business in there, and Mondragon would be the core of it.
So if you were your younger self, your 18-year-old, 18 years younger self, looking at Mondragon today, do you think you would be happy with how everything went?
Well, I think that it became less about the politics. It just grew to these proportions that you weren't able to focus on the politics and the activism that was really what its intention was.
Then there was a period in the last few months where people weren't getting paid at all because there wasn't enough money to go around. Do you know how long people weren't getting paid?
Well, we've been struggling to pay people since probably the spring, and we were able to pay people more in the summer because we were busy with a few things, and then it got back to that, like really, really struggling to pay people. And we've been able to sort of eke out a little bit here and there for people that like desperately needed it, but not enough for anybody to live on. Like, not people are scrambling to pay their rent, and let alone have any kind of money for anything extra that they might have in their lives. So it's that's been true since August.
Since the summertime, that's been the hardest time for me personally. Like, not only when people have left because they needed to find paying work, it becomes difficult not only because we can't fill shifts and we can't stay open to make money, but also there's like a huge amount of work that is left on the remaining people to keep the restaurant open, but also to keep the business functioning. Like, an incredible amount of work.
And the way we are raised in our culture is to just follow orders. And then what you get is you get all these people that are thrown into this place where they're told to make decisions collectively and to get along and to do these things that no one's been trained to. That was really challenging. We weren't making a lot of money. And to say we got paid minimum wage is ignoring all of the sort of expected volunteer time. So I did the math after I left, and I was making about $4 an hour for every hour I put into the place.
We want to reach consensus, but without actively and constantly training and looking at that and learning about it, it doesn't work, because we aren't we aren't brought up like that. In fact, we're brought up the opposite to that. Mm-hmm. And so people are coming with like, they don't have it. They don't know how to do it. I think that was one of the failures of Mondragon and probably other projects, is that we don't say, okay, well, how do we work collectively? You would have meetings and you'd have people like super opinionated on something and gonna challenge it and fight to the death for something, and then 2 weeks later they'd be giving their notice. We wanted to have all of those ideas and all those people involved. I think we made it too complicated and too big then. We should have simplified it more, I think.
It was a place that was legitimately living its values and workplace democracy in a really legitimate way. So to see that stop is hard. And Winnipeg, I think, is poorer for it.
But I also think that the A-Zone is suffering from the same mistakes that Mondragon suffered from, in that it's gotten too big. It's too much of an emphasis on the bank and the mortgage and the lawyers and the leases, and like that's the focus of these meetings.
The excitement is not there. People seem burnt out. Like, I haven't gone into the Mondragon or the A-Zone in the last couple years and not seeing people just look stressed.
Like, this point now, Mondragon closing, I think is actually, like, the best decision we've made in a long time. Because, like, we've been open for the last half year, but I think we've been open in a way that hasn't been healthy for the people working there. And I really feel like, for the community, like, each individual person's health is so important.
And I always said it's better to close with the politics intact than it would be to lose the politics and maintain and be open. That's not a success to me. So we have been successful. Like, we've always maintained them. And I think 18 years is an amazing run. And I think that's an amazing historical project we have now for Winnipeg.
Following the Bedford ruling in September, striking down three of the laws criminalizing sex work, there's been much discussion as to the future. A panel took place on Mississauga's of New Credit territory at the U of T Law School. Krista Bigcanoe, Legal Advocacy Director of the Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto, spoke to the importance of consulting the people who are most marginalized in creating new laws.
The community we represent in Toronto includes sex workers and non-sex workers, but mostly what it includes is an abundance of Aboriginal women who experience a high level of victimization, not just in sex work, but violence, whether it's domestic violence, collateral violence, colonial violence, a history of trauma. And so when we decide to do something like intervene in a case like this, we try to bring that perspective to the court's attention. Anyone who's read the Bedford decision will not find the word Aboriginal. They will not see the word Aboriginal woman. They will not see the word colonialism. Constitutionally, we've got a good decision. What happens? What's the time frame? So what happens is they suspend the decision for a year so the policymakers, the lawmakers can make a determination. That's not enough time. What's going to happen in a year? A government is going to rush through legislation. They're going to rush through legislation without the biggest, most important thing, and that's consultation. Remember that at the end of the day, it's human beings who are missing and murdered and who face the perils. And without safety and protection and good legislation, it won't matter. Until we talk and have consultation, it won't matter. It'll be more law that will just be continuously in a cycle of litigation.
Katrina Pacey, Legal Director of Pivot Legal Society, also stressed the importance of consulting sex workers as we move forward.
We've arrived in this amazing place where, thanks to Terry Jean Bedford, Amy Leibovich, Valerie Scott, we have this incredible opportunity. This moment in time where those three women stood up on behalf of the movement nationally, went to court, fought in front of, you know, three levels of court, eventually in front of nine justices at the Supreme Court of Canada, and won. And it was an amazing victory. But we're at a moment now where we need to hold on to it, where we need to ask ourselves, where should Canada go post-Bedford? We're talking about moving forward. And the most important thing that I would like you to take home from this is that we need to listen to sex workers, that they need to have a leadership role in all future law and policy development. And what I'm here to tell you is that this is an opportunity where we need to look at the harms and the failures and the disaster of criminalization and start to think about a new approach. So my hope is that in this talk, as I talk to you about the conversations I'm having with sex workers in the downtown East Side about what would happen if Canada recriminalizes or criminalizes sex work in a different way, the disasters and tragedies that will continue in that community. How do you actually ever operate or open up or work in a safer indoor space when all the police have to do is sit out front and target your clients as they go through the door, or surveil your clients as they go through the door? So in fact, the spirit of the Bedford decision, the spirit behind being able to incur or allow sex workers, or at least remove laws that were creating barriers for sex workers to being able to set up these indoor spaces, that spirit or that intention or that benefit is completely lost if you have a new law in place that then criminalizes clients.
Cheryl Auger, board member of Maggie's, the Sex Worker Action Project, discuss some of the ways that different types of sex work are currently regulated at the municipal level and what that means for workers.
So let's begin by asking who's licensed. And this varies across Canada's cities. Different cities have different policies. So in Toronto, for example, exotic dancers or strippers are licensed, as well as recently managers and for a long time owners. Body rub parlors, owners are licensed, as well as the so-called body rubbers, the workers there. Holistic practitioners are licensed, and holistic centers are licensed. In other cities, escorts are actually already licensed, like in Edmonton. Additionally, I've heard a number of strippers and erotic massage workers express concerns that the licenses are really expensive, but they don't provide any value added. They don't make their workplace better. They don't ensure labor rights are protected. I've heard repeatedly that these licenses are, I quote, a cash grab. And as I've said, high license fees make it difficult for some people to get started in state-regulated parts of the sex trade. Additionally, licensing means that there's a state record of participation in stigmatized industries, and it's not clear to me who has access to this record.
Recently, several provinces, including New Brunswick, Alberta, Ontario, BC, and Newfoundland and Labrador, have advised their Crown attorneys to suspend prosecution of sex workers to some degree following the Bedford decision. Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. The annual Homelessness Marathon is coming up on February 26th. I had the opportunity to speak with Roshni, this year's coordinator at CGSR in Edmonton.
The Homelessness Marathon is a nationally broadcast radiothon that takes place over the course of a night. And it features about 14 hours of radio content from across Canada about the issue of homelessness and also the solutions. And it's been hosted in Montreal for the last 11 years by CKUT. And this is the first year that it's moved elsewhere, and we're really proud and excited to have it here in Edmonton. We'll be connecting with around 40 other campus and community radio stations to air segments that they're hosting live, but also it'll be broadcast simultaneously across the country over the course of the night. And that night is February 26th from 5 p.m. to 7 a.m. Mountain Time, and it's a Wednesday. The heart of the marathon is about connecting with individuals who are experiencing homelessness as individuals, as people. And so I think with this idea of income inequality in our cities, and especially in a city as spread out as Edmonton, we have very distinct communities. And I don't know if your listeners are aware, in Edmonton we've had a rather prolonged suburban issue. There was a housing complex to be developed in one of our suburbs, Terwilliger, and the community kind of rose up against it in uproar, mainly because of miscommunication, but there was also this kind of those people don't belong here, NIMBYism in the story. And I think that issue and that story really spoke to the gap in empathy, I think, that income inequality creates, where you can actually exist in a suburb and have poverty not be part of your life. And, you know, you can kind of create and concoct a fantasy world where you don't have to encounter people who are poor at any point in your day. And so the marathon, I think, is about breaking down that empathy gap. It's about reminding people that we're all human. We all go through, you know, the same hopes, dreams, and desires as, you know, with the same as each other. And so we're starting the marathon off this year in a public library, which I think is a very important space because it's one of the few spaces in our city where, you know, just regardless of income, you're welcome. And that kind of public space is rare and becoming rarer, I think, because of this privatization of different social enterprises. And so I'm hoping that that kind of puts a spotlight on this bridge building that we have to do between people and reminding us of the humanity that exists within all of us, regardless of our income or our class or, you know, whether we have a roof over our heads. So that's kind of where that's going in terms of the marathon and kind of the overarching picture that I hope is illustrated this year. And I mean, specifically to Edmonton, it is referring back to how our city is kind of divided into different communities of income, and we kind of get lost in our different suburban communities and our different inner city communities as well, because the shelter is also a very isolating place meant for, you know, only people without housing in a way. So hopefully the marathon is about bridging that gap. For more information about the 2014 Homelessness Marathon on February 26, 2014, you can visit cjsrnews.com/homeless, or you can email me, Roshni, at marathon@cjsr.com. And then I also encourage people to participate during the marathon by calling the toll-free line at 1-866-594-7729. And we'll have that on our websites. You can also tune in during the marathon at cjsr.com.
And that's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at LU Radio on Fort William First Nations territory in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Headlines this week were by Aaron Lakoff. We also thank Red Eye Co-op Radio, Daniel Emberg, and Fatima Herrera. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download the latest episode at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.